Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Dan Snow's History Hit, an important podcast, this one. As the markets tumble, as people panic buy, we've got a historical, we've got the long view on coronavirus, on influenza. We're talking to one of the world's leading virologists. Professor John Oxford is the UK's top expert on influenza. He's Emeritus Professor of Virology at the University of London. His work on the 1918 strain of influenza, known as Spanish flu, is world famous. He's the founder of Retro Screen Virology, and that is a leader in the fields of vaccine and antiviral clinical trials over the last 20 years. He's a man who works trying to create antiviral drugs every day, but he's also a man who's gone into enormous detail looking at the outbreak of influenza during and after the First World War. And I just wanted to ask him some very simple questions. What are the lessons from history? What are the lessons from previous influenza outbreaks that can help us overcome this one? One of the reasons, surely, for knowing your history is so that we are armed, we are forewarned, we are prepared for the next time similar events happen to those that have happened in the past. Nothing is ever, of course, a perfect parallel, a perfect reflection, but there are things that we learn in all sorts of fields that we can build on and improve and can potentially provide us with a lifeline in times like this. For those of you who have been asking how they can support us at Team History Hit, the best way to do that is to subscribe to History Hit TV. We've taken lots of the back catalogue, lots of the archive now off iTunes, wherever you get your podcasts. The whole podcast archive is exclusively there on History Hit TV, along with hundreds of history documentaries as well. We're trying really hard to make it one of the best history resources on the planet, so please head over there to historyhit.tv and subscribe. You can use the code POD1, you get 30 days free, and then you get your first month, which is £1, euro, or dollar. So that's a pretty sweet deal. So thank you very much. Head over to historyhit.tv to use that code, POD1. In the meantime, everybody, here is Professor John Oxford. I really hope you find this useful. Enjoy. John, thank you very much for coming on the podcast.
Yeah, pleasure.
So we are, you're a brilliant human being because you're a scientist, but also a historian, really. So you can help us untangle the lessons of the great flu pandemic of the second decade of the 20th century. Let's start with things that we can learn, because you've broadcasted about this subject very, very effectively. What is the number one lesson that human beings, that scientists derived from the great flu pandemic of the First World War and the years following?
Well, I tell you what I derive from it personally, but before I do that, let me say one thing. You mentioned I've got an interest in history, but I also have a medical historian in tow with me, and that's Douglas Gill. And so we tend to work together on that. I tend to do the virology and a bit of the history. He tends to do the history and a spot of virology, so that we make quite a nice team. Now, your question about what do I pull out from when I think about the outbreak, what I pull out is based on the great Gauguin painting, the great scientific painting, the last one he painted, the one he loved most, the one they can't move out of out from Boston where it is. And it's a great painting as a triptych. Where have we come from? He entitled it, Where Have We Come From? Who Are We? And Where Are We Going? And I often think of that because it's absolutely perfect for this sort of thing, a great infection. So where have we come from? We have come from a world of infection. That's Gauguin's world. We're still in that world. Things have not changed in 100, or how many years it is, from Gauguin's time, 1890, painted it, I think. It is still a world of infection. We've only eradicated two organisms, that's smallpox and rinderpest. All the other bacteria and viruses are still out there. So we're still in a world of infection. And then he asked the question, where are we going? Well, I think we're still there. Hopefully, we are going in a more scientific direction than we have in the past. But I think even there, I worry about it sometimes, with people who believe that evolution didn't happen, there's a flat earth and all that sort of thing. And then the biggest question of all, who are we? And I think in these great cataclysmic events, and I'm not saying this, the one at the moment, is a great cataclysmic event, but it is certainly stirring everyone up, including myself. We don't know how we're going to react until we're faced with it. And I remember this, when the SARS outbreak started, I had a telephone call, fairly irate, an agitated call from a lady anaesthetist. And she said, look, first of all, you don't know anything about it. And I said, well, none of us know anything about it. And secondly, she said, well, I'm on the front line, I don't want to be here. I didn't join. If I wanted to be on the front line, I could sign up with Medicine Sans Frontières. But here I am, an anaesthetist, and I'm not coming into work. So I thought then, you know, we are confronted. We don't know until we get that confrontation what is going to happen. And I give everything to those nurses and doctors at the moment, in China particularly, which is where we're facing, if we want to find out anything about this, how to stop it, where it came from, all this sort of thing. They've already gave their lives, some of them, in this endeavour to stop an infection, and that will happen here as well.
Right. Well, that's the big that's the big headline thought. Thank you. What was the nature of the flu outbreak that began in sort of 1917-18? What we hear now about this being a disease that attacks the respiratory system. We hear that it disproportionately affects people who are immunocompromised or older people. Is that different or similar to 1917?
What hit them in 1918, I think, in the face, and what hits us, and what hits me when I go into a library and look around, is the people who were hit by this great wave, the first great wave that came in 1918, in the summer of 1918, and there were young people. They were not the elderly group. They were not the particularly young group. They were a specific age. There were 27, 28, 29, and 30-year-olds. That's where the highest mortality was. And To be frank about it, we are still grappling with that. Why did it hit that particular age group? And you're quite right, we are grappling with things from the past and trying to work out indeed what happened there. And I think as we do that, that can give us a pointer here. We found out, all of us working around the world on this project, that they must have had a particular history, these 28, 29, 30, coming from the past. They must have either missed out a flu wave, you know, 20 years before, or alternatively, the opposite. They got one for themselves, but they were different. They must have been different in their past history of flu, and then for some reason or other, they were knocked off their feet. The elderly group, where you would normally expect, as you quite rightly say, to be hit on the head, like what's happening now with COVID-19, they were completely free of it. They sailed through the 1918. Unfortunately, the younger age group, the children, didn't sail through. They were afflicted. Not as bad as the 27, 28, 29-year-olds, but they were certainly afflicted. And, of course, that is one of the big conundrums at the moment with the COVID, because it's not seen to be producing much pathology or much serious infection in children. It's just going for the other age groups and the elderly.
What was done was anything effective done in the great flu pandemic that helped to lessen them? Are there any successes? Are there any things that we can use today to combat this next pandemic?
Yes, there's a lot, I think, because after all, when I wake up in the morning, I woke up this morning thinking we were going to do this. I thought, right, what I really like to do and what I really like to have is a pill in my pocket labelled anti-COVID-19 or anti-coronavirus pill that I could take if I'd been in contact with a case or if I began to get ill, take the tablet. That is an antiviral drug. But there isn't such a pill. The second thing is I'd like to have is a diagnostic kit, one that would give me the answer in 15 minutes. And I think that could be developed, but certainly not at the moment. And the other thing I'd like to have for the more medium term is a vaccine. Well, that's not there either. So in a sense, this is the awesome thing about it. we're sitting here now in the same sense. If we'd been 100, whatever it is, 120 years ago, which is, we are unarmed, and that's not a very happy situation to be in either. I can tell you that. And it's the first time I've ever been in such a situation in a pandemic. And I've gone through the flu pandemics in 57, 68, you know, 77, 2009. There's always been this background. If we've got something behind us, don't worry. We'll be okay. Antibiotics and all that. Here, we're pretty helpless in a way. And I sometimes wonder why we've got ourselves in this spot. But having said all that, in 1918, they really began to get a moving on. They used the same sort of techniques that we're using now. Quarantine, public health, hand washing. Of course, the pictures are famous from that time with the masks. Everyone, you know, the New York policemen wearing masks. The famous picture of what was going on in 1918. But the same sort of ways of doing it. And it did seem to work because they published, people have gone through the data a few years ago of what happened in the great cities in the United States, for example. And they compared them. They compared what action they took. If they took no action at all, and some of them didn't take any action for reasons best known to themselves, the riots roared in, caused trouble, a lot of trouble, deaths and illness and that, and they roared out again, just roared through. And they were caught napping. They couldn't cope with it. In cities where they said, right, we'll try hand washing, and then we'll see how that goes. And then if that doesn't work, we'll go on to a mask. And if that doesn't work, we'll go on social distancing. That didn't do much good either. This just try this, try that, try something else. In those cities where they threw everything at this virus, everything at the same time, the hand washing, the masks, the social distancing, the closing of schools, the closing of theatres, threw it at them. What happened there was, you flattened the epidemic hit. The curve that was going up in other cities didn't go up so steeply. It was kind of prolonged. But that meant you had more time to deal with things. There wasn't so much panic around, flapping around, because you could keep businesses going, keep things going as the outbreak was prolonged. So they did things. Some cities did. And you can ask why some did and some didn't. And there's a danger point there as well.
So if in 1918 to 19, what are the approximate dates? Do we think it began in 17 or did it begin in 18?
I think personally it began there were indications in the British Army of things going on, of respiratory things going on in Aldershot Barracks, for example, where the recruits were coming in about 1916. And by the end of 1916, the winter of 1916-17, there began to be outbreaks. It wasn't apparent immediately to the pathologists, and they were on the lookout for things because by the First World War, the British Army and other armies had realised that an infection was a thing that could decimate an army. You know, since the Boer War, you had to make sure, and the Crimean War, you make sure the infection was down, and they increased the hygiene, hand washing, disinfecting, and they're all doing that. But in spite of that, by 1916-17, there was quite a lot of, it seemed to be a lot of strange deaths around, mainly in the great army camps that were pulled in Aldershot Barracks near London and along the Western Front. And to get a grasp of all this, we have to appreciate the size of this endeavour on the Western Front. Britain was emptied or half emptied of all its doctors, all its pathologists, and nurses. Not all of them, about 60% of them were moved to the Western Front, and they joined these huge encampments all the way along for 100 miles along there, where these hospitals were built. The pathology laboratories were built, and they were set up to bring in casualties, war wounded, and then they began to bring in casualties as well, of medical casualties, and they began to note that something was up. And a small team of pathologists, three of them actually, working at Etape, which is one of the biggest camps, holding maybe 30, holding on one day 100,000 troops while they were sorted out, that had enough hospitals for 20,000. So it was a big endeavour. And in that environment, they began to notice something odd. But it wasn't until a pathologist arrived and a morbid anatomist arrived just after Christmas that they began to sort out exactly what was going on. And then they realised that a lot of these soldiers had been dying. They'd been dying of something that was strangely looking like influenza in the pathology. It looked a little strange. But then they thought to themselves, well, if it was influenza, why wasn't it spreading? Could it be influenza? And so they decided on a halfway house. It was new, this disease. They published it in The Lancet. It was new, but it perhaps it wasn't quite influenza. It was something else. It wasn't spreading, so maybe they didn't have to panic on it. Now, all these years later, we can look back and say, well, hang on a minute, that's just like it is in Hong Kong at the moment, or over the years, the recent years. There's been a bird flu, could spread around the world, but it's not. It's just holding itself in Hong Kong for the moment. Perhaps it will spread, but it's not at the moment. And I think that's what was happening at Etaples. At that moment, they discovered it was a high mortality in those soldiers, just like bird flu is a high mortality in Hong Kong when it hits people. But it's not got the ability to spread. So at the moment, it needs to mutate and change. And I think the outbreak, personally, the outbreak started there in Europe in 1916, 17. The conflicting idea, the other idea, is that it started in the United States in Kansas. More or less a bit later than that at the same time. So there's no, and that China is a possibility, but very low down on the scheme of things for starting.
By the time it's sweeping through famously the big US cities, how does it compare? And we all know the figures now. We're all amateurs like me are all terribly knowledgeable now. A little bit of information is a dangerous thing. And we talk about 3.4% at the World Health Organization. And what kind of... Was the disease similar to the, in terms of its danger to what we're seeing today?
No, I wouldn't put it like that. I think there's too much comparison. It definitely works people up. As you say, everyone, we've all got to think. I go to meetings. It's pretty strange, and I always have. And people argue, even scientists argue. Oh, they say, well, did 50 million people die? Or did 60 million people? And in a flash of a moment, we've got rid of 10 million people. And sometimes I've been to meetings where 100 million people have died in 1918. So we bandy around the figures. And personally, I think that it unnerves people. It unnerves me. And I've spent a lifetime in it. And I rather concentrate on one. What I'm always want to do with this pandemic is look at one person who died. And then from that, you can get something useful from it. How did that one person react? How did their family react? And you can then multiply it by the figure you like. I don't think this outbreak now, the COVID-19, it has got any similarity in numbers to the 19 or to indeed any other flu pandemic. Because after all, in recent pandemics, this recent year in England, we've had 5,000-6,000 people die of flu. No one seemed to bother about it. They've only just stopped dying because of the end of the flu season, the end of the winter. And that's one thing I think about this COVID-19. It's missed its chance, actually, because they love the winter time. We're all crowded indoors, swapping, exchanging tales with each other and getting infected. Once the spring starts, all these respiratory infections begin to drop. And you could look at it another way. In the pandemic of 1918, that virus hit, first of all, in a big way, in June that year, May, June that year. It's not far from where we are now. But it hit the summer. It didn't do all that well. It didn't do all well at all. And everyone relaxed. And then by November, back it came. And people didn't relax. That's when the main mortality, the figures we're talking about, a lot of it, about half of the mortality came in October, November 1918. And then I suppose people relaxed again, which is not a sensible thing to do, because in February it was back again. And the other half got swallowed up. So that is telling us that... Beware of these respiratory viruses. Take all the precautions you can, that they won't knock in and knock everyone off, as it were, in one great wave. They won't. It'll be a number of waves. So that can give some reassurance of what could happen now. But be pretty careful with them. And that when they're in this way, they're unpredictable. They do like the seasonal. They do. They can come in the summer, but they like the winter period, as all these respiratory infections do. And that is a big component, a negative component. The spring and the summer can be a positive affair.
So the best practice, you're saying, in 1918, flattened the graph effectively. What else could have been done? I mean, what have we learned in the 100 years since that is going to make us even more resilient and better able to deal with this?
Join us this month on Gone Medieval from History Hit. I'm Matt Lewis.
And I'm Eleanor Yonaga. This April, dive into our special mini-series.
With the help of leading experts, we're tracing the foundations of England by exploring the country's most powerful Anglo-Saxon kingdoms.
We'll be looking at Northumbria, Mercia, and Wessex, as well as the rulers and their councils who helped shape a nation.
Make sure to get every episode by listening and following Gone Medieval from History Hit, wherever you get your podcasts.
We've learnt that they struggled, that they were faced with something that we've had preparation for. Do you remember, we've had plans drawn up. Every country in the world was asked by the World Health Organization since 1997, when the bird flu began moving from birds to humans, to prepare for a pandemic. Get the plans out, every factory, every, you know, we've got plans all over the place. They're bulging out of doors, the plans. But the biggest lesson is to move with all you've got quickly. That's what I've derived from it. Why wait if you're going to have all this, these things, like the layered approach? Why are you doing the one bit, minute, one this? Why are you saying, let's ban handshaking now, but we'll let kissing go ahead? Or, you know, it just seems silly. It just seems silly. And it seems though we've not learnt anything from 1918. What I've learnt from it was, faced with a new virus like this, you throw everything at it as soon as possible.
Is the counter argument, of course, that, you know, poor old politicians don't hear that very often, but they're trying to balance the resilience to a new disease against kind of widespread economic dislocation that could have, you know, years. And we know people die when the economy goes south. People lose their jobs. People at the margins, economic margins, society suffer extreme hardship, and actually mortality goes up there. So is it quite difficult for politicians to know when it's, you know, this is not a drill, this is the real one? I mean, what are the signals that you have to, what are the triggers for when you would say, right, let's throw the kitchen sink at it?
Well, I said about the trigger that I have is when the infection starts in your own country and you think it could be pandemic because you've just looked at another country, that is China. And you look there and you say, my goodness me, what's going on? Although we have to remember that in China now, they've had 3,000 deaths in a population of, what, 1 billion? They've had maybe 100,000 infections in a population of a billion. So it's not as though the whole country's been swarmed over with it. And that's another lesson we learnt from 1918 and from subsequent pandemics, actually in 57, 68, that this virus does not come in. These viruses, that's flu, they don't come in, and I suspect this is the same with COVID-19-18, they don't come in and sweep over the whole country like that. They will come in waves. And even in a wave, some areas won't be hit at all. So you could have a situation where London, you know, where there's a lot of people move coming in flying, gets a whack. And up in Northamptonshire or somewhere, they wonder what on earth's going on. So it could be spotty. And sometimes these pandemics, and that's what I was hoping, in 1968, I was a virologist by 1968, and I remember the discussion in the lab. So Charles Stuart Harris was the one in charge, and he was always a bit bossy. And he came in and he said, right, you know, this is it, 68, it's going to come roaring in, you know. But it didn't. It went roaring in the United States. And in England, nothing happened. Well, hardly anything happened. And the next year, not all that much happened. And then the year after, it did. So there was a delay in some European countries, and some European countries didn't get it at all. And I remember Poland, they said, what, this pandemic in 68, well, what's it all about then? So it can be a bit dotted around and not consistent as well, and that can sometimes help you. Now, as regards politicians and virologists, people like me, I'm not doing their job for them. That's up to them to do their job. My job is to analyse the medical scientific impact of a great infection. And I think that what I would not want to see, I'm not going to sacrifice my granddad just because something can carry on and make some money. And that's not the way I look at it. I'm here to prevent and do all my best to prevent getting ill, prevent people getting ill, and prevent people dying of a disease that is nasty and in the end will be prevented. I wouldn't want to look back after this and say, my grandchildren, I've got plenty of them, I can tell you, and they'll say to me, well, what did you do then, Grandad, during the great COVID-19? And I say, well, I sat on my hands and did nothing, or I was very worried about whether the railway companies would make less money during that time because there's less travelling. I don't want to be involved in that. That's not my involvement. My involvement is saying, well, I helped. I tried to develop a vaccine. I tried to develop a mask. or an antiviral and persuade people to go out there and not shake hands, not kiss, not hug, not do those things that this virus loves. I mean, you don't catch this virus on the road or on a tree. You catch it from someone else, and you catch it when they breathe on you or cough on you either way, and they're pretty close to you. So the simple thing is to keep away from people, which is called social distancing.
Okay, so there we go. So another lesson from history, social distancing. Talk us through it. So if you maintain that invisible box, is it a 2 metre square around yourself?
Yes, less than that, I think, myself, but you can argue it out. Because there's a lot of information that's been taken out of the flu world, the plans and all that, and just thrown across to the COVID-19 world. And I'm not so sure that it's all applicable. And this 2 metre business, if you... And I think now we're thinking less that these infections are spread by coughing and sneezing. You know, you don't sneeze when you've got flu. And I don't think you sneeze when you've got COVID-19. You cough, but you're not coughing all the time. What you're mainly doing all the time is breathing. So you ask yourself, well, hang on a minute. The virus is in your upper airways and perhaps in your lower airways. It's there in very large numbers. We're talking about 10 billion viruses in a small area. So when you breathe, do they come pushed out with their breath? Because you're breathing a lot of litres of air all the time. So is it tidal breathing that's spreading it? And my answer is, I think it is. And the way I look at it is, if you get close enough to someone to smell their breath, if they've had garlic for breakfast and you can smell garlic, you are breathing in their breath and they're breathing in yours. And so that is pretty close. It's probably a couple of feet away and you're facing them out as well. Which is why handshaking should be curtailed in spite of the virologists, our Prime Minister virologist and the American President virologist telling us that they're going to continue doing things they've always done. The thing about handshaking is it brings you close into someone and you face them normally. And so you begin to smell their breath and you will begin to pick up their viruses, I think. So, you know, there are things that we can do, and I hope people are going to do it as soon as possible.
Okay, so social distancing works. That's a good lesson from history. What in terms of our resilience as a society, in terms of, you know, we now have amazing people like you working away at stuff. Are we stupid question from a layperson, but developing drugs that can help. How different are we now to where we were in 1918 with our AI and our teams of people like you?
Well, it's not a silly question to ask. And in fact, when I look back now, a few years, I think, what have we done? Are we responsible? As someone like, am I responsible as a virologist? Why didn't I react differently in 2000, after 2003? So here was a coronavirus. I dealt with coronaviruses like 50 years ago when I was a student. There were innocent little things, innocent family, in the humans anyway, causing respiratory disease, coughs, and they were among the common cold viruses that we all have every year. They're still around. They're still around now. But they're innocent. They've never cured anyone in their life, as far as I can see, a coronavirus. And I had a little chance. They've just been isolated, these coronas, down at the common cold unit in Salisbury, a quarantine unit where they studied these common colds. And my little task was to grow it up, look at it, and you'd break my hands, get myself into the laboratory. And so I'd have a history of looking at them, dealing with them. And suddenly in 2003, what happens? So this SARS coronavirus suddenly appears. Now, we were all taken by, you know, a coronavirus causing that. Don't believe it. But it did. But of course, what happened was, using the public health methods that we're using now, quarantine, social distancing, so on, it was snuffed out, really, alongside the fact that these coronas haven't got the get up and go that influenza's got. They just don't. If we were in this infection being caused by influenza, we wouldn't be talking about 3 deaths, as bad as that is, and 60 cases. We'd be talking about 1,000 deaths or a couple of thousand and 100,000 cases. It was flu. It's got the get up and go and it's got the zip. But these coronaviruses don't have that. So you could say, well, all right, we hit SARS and it hit itself on the head. 6,000 people in a globe of 8 billion got infected in 20 different countries, and then vanished. Now, that was the problem, because it did its damage, which wasn't very nice, and then we all thought, well, it's over. This is a very rare phenomenon, corona. You know, it's a one in a poke in the moon sort of thing. So how could I go along, I suppose, is my only excuse, to a pharmaceutical group and say, why don't you spend £2 billion making a vaccine? And they turn around and say, well, how many people died? And I say, well, 300. And they say, well, you know, there are other more important infections around. And the same with antivirals and the same with diagnostic kits. And so we coasted along until a few years, and suddenly there was another one coming from a camel and from a bat. The SARS came from a bat to a civet cat in a market in Guangdong. The next one came from a bat into possibly a rat and then into a camel and into a humans in Saudi. And still we didn't react. And now suddenly we got this one. So I think there's been a lack of reaction, I must say that, on the part of the scientific community, the virological community, when really perhaps we should have got our kit together and got moving.
Well, don't blame yourself. But I'm sure you still have more than nearly everybody else on the planet put together. But I'm asking, like, what it now that you are taking it seriously, are you hopeful? I mean, can things move much faster than they did in 1918, for example?
Well, that's a nice way of putting it. Everything's moving faster. And I think the population movements, that helps the virus move around. My goodness, the number of people travelling, my children, I never seem to be around. They're always in Timbuktu or somewhere, you know. You get on a plane, go, pay £50, and you're there. So it's a world of movement. That's fantastic for a virus spreading. But on the other hand, it helps us communicate with I'm in touch with people. I mean, I'm phoning daily to Australia to talk to my colleague there, to find out what's going on and so forth. So we're in touch all right, and that helps as well. So I think we're reacting more. And I noticed recently what pleased me, 50,000 molecules for repurposing, what's called repurposing. We've all been busy making drugs against HIV, hepatitis C, B, influenza. There's a new influenza drug. But we can maybe repurpose them. We can say, well, we've developed this drug against smallpox. I mean, that, for example, years and years and years ago. Could that possibly have an effect against COVID-19 out of all expectations? So 50,000 of those arrived last week at probably the most famous laboratory, Eric de Klerk's laboratory in the University of Louvain in Belgium. These are probably the most famous antiviral chemotherapists. 50,000 of these drugs arrived. They're going to screen the whole lot against this new virus in the laboratory and see if one of them will be a hit. They can do that quite quickly. There's already three hits. There's this remdesivir. There is a nucleotide analog drug, which I think looks pretty good. And a young virologist from Holland has put it through a macaque model. It looks against SARS. It looked like it could work. So we're not absolutely totally bereft. We're almost bereft, but not quite. So now I think the Chinese are working on that too. So I've got great expectations that because of this international issue with the way we're all cooperating, that someone will pull an antiviral drug out of the cupboard or discover one new. That can be done quite quickly. The vaccine business is much more difficult. Although some of the methodologies have shortened things, you've still got a lot of control, a lot of biology to do, a lot of worry about giving a biological to a person. So I don't see a vaccine coming along for another maybe 18 months. That's something that's fit and safe. What we have done, and I was very proud about it, we began to focus on this pandemic several years ago. In fact, soon after the bird flu started coming up and in Hong Kong. And we thought, I looked around and thought, there isn't a monument. There isn't a kind of, the world is full of monuments to soldiers, mainly men, who died in the First World War. My father was in it. He didn't die, but he was in it. He shouldn't have been in it. And the place is coming in every village in Britain. Where is the monument to the 200,000 Britons, English people, who died in the pandemic? There isn't one. And so we had an opportunity just behind the London Hospital. There's a church called St. Philip's and St. Augustine. It's kind of a Victorian church. And in the Second World War, all the glass windows were blown out in a bombing attack. And we had the opportunity of putting them back and getting them redesigned. And so we got one. My group did one. And we based it on Gauguin, the painting I told you about. And it's a triptych window in deep, deep blues. Deep reds and things, but it's a wonderful window, and it's the commemorative window for people who died, and it issued a medal to families who helped each other in 1918, and it brought out, in most often, it brought out the best in people. It issued a memorial medal to doctors and nurses, not only in the hospital, not in the Royal London, but everywhere, who put their lives on hold to help other people, but particularly, I feel, personally, it offers a medal to women who, in their own homes, helped people. It was a virus where, and I think this is going to be the same if people do die, there are a lot of people who will die quietly at home. And I was finding a series of letters by a young woman called Gwen, a Welsh woman. She was 21, I think. And she was fine. She was writing to her mother every day. Her mother was in another valley in Wales. They'd write backs and forwards. And 3 days before she died, Gwen, she was in, you know, she was young. She was in the age group almost that the mortality was most. She was saying, "I'm fine, Mum. Dad's a bit worried about me, but don't you worry. You worry about yourself." And she was being looked after by the family. She didn't realise that was going to be done. Then suddenly the letter stopped. "I'm fine. I'm fine. Don't you worry about me. You worry about yourself." So this letter, this memorial, this window, is called the Remembrance of the Men and Women, particularly the women who died in the Great Influenza Pandemic of 1918 and who helped each other.
That sounds very beautiful. I'm going to go and check it out next time I'm there. So we'll end it there, but thank you very much. So the lessons from history is government should act fast, we should distance ourselves, and then within our family units, any advice for how we can be more like Gwen?
Everyone, it's like crowdfunding. You know, everyone does a little bit to get President Obama, give $10 to get him elected. You don't need just a few squillionaires. Everyone can do a little bit here, and I'm not joking here. Everyone does their bit. If you say, "What are you doing then?" "Well, I'm not going around the world. I'm not going to flit over to France. I'm going to use fewer aircraft." And so anything where you could get in contact with people and spread it, if you have got it yourself inadvertently, you can do things by, over the next few months, and I think we'll have to take, and I accept your point about the economic hit, I think we'll just have to take that. We're a wealthy country. After all, we are. And, you know, we do less travelling. We go to fewer football matches and fewer rugby matches. That could be someone's big sacrifice. They look after their grandparents because they could have a jolly good time and their children have a jolly good time. They bring home and give a virus to their grandparents, which would kill them. So they keep an eye on that and they behave properly. They do not start blaming China for all this and the Chinese. No one blames Britain for starting the pandemic in 1918, and I think we did start it because all the First World War and the crowding and the things going on and the things at remembrance of things at 1918 when it finished, or if it started in America. We don't blame America for starting the pandemic, which killed 50 million people, and we cannot blame the Chinese either. Otherwise, we're really getting into problems here. So I'd like to see more careful thought, a lot of careful thought. We can do it. Everyone can do this thought, and also a personal contribution with the hand washing, the social distancing, and all the things we know have worked in the past and can work now.
Thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you, Dan.
I feel the hand of history upon our shoulders.
All this tradition of ours, our school history, our songs, this part of the history of our country, all were gone and finished and liquidated.
One child, one teacher, one book, and one pen can change the world.
He tells us what is possible, not just in the pages of history books, but in our own lives as well.
I have faith in you.
Hope you enjoyed the podcast. Just before you go, bit of a favour to ask. I totally understand if you don't want to become a subscriber or pay me any cash money. Makes sense. But if you could just do me a favour, it's for free. Go to iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. If you give it a 5-star rating and give it an absolutely glowing review, purge yourself, give it a glowing review. I'd really appreciate that. It's a tough world out there. Law of the jungle out there. And I need all the fire support I can get. So that will boost it up the charts. It's so tiresome. But if you could do it, I'd be very, very grateful. Thank you.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Dan Snow's History It. Please follow this show wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps us and you'll be doing us a big favour. Don't forget you can also listen to all of these podcasts ad-free and watch hundreds of TV documentaries when you subscribe at historyhit.com/subscribe. As a special gift, you can also get your first 3 months for just £1 a month when you use code DANSNOW at checkout.